Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Cameron is out. Carmen is in a surprising reversal this weekend. Interim Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best is now one of the three finalists for the permanent chief of police position. Remember, she initially was not included on that list of the final three, but that changed when one of the original finalists, Cameron McClay, withdrew his application. McClay has agreed, apparently, to take a different job with the Seattle Police Department, assisting on reform efforts. We'll explain all of this now with the able help of the city reporter with Crosscut, David Croman. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
So, not all of us are familiar with this story. So, will you catch us up, first of all, on the news of this weekend? What was this reversal about?
So, a few months ago, this group of, over the last few months, this group of 25 people has been searching for a replacement for Kathleen O'Toole as the permanent head of the Seattle Police Department. This group of 25 people returned five names, including Carmen Best, who was the second in command under Kathleen O'Toole. But then there was this sort of separate group of mayoral appointed people who whittled that five down from three. And when that happened, Carmen Best was cut out of that three, which was sort of a big shock to everybody.
Why was she cut out?
So at the time, they said because they wanted an outsider. They felt like the reform efforts that have begun under the Seattle Police Department haven't gone far enough. And they said that they thought somebody from somewhere not in Seattle would be the best person to carry those forward.
And remind us what we mean by reform efforts.
So in 2012, the Seattle Police Department agreed to basically overhaul its use of force practices under a federally mandated consent decree. We're in this sort of wind down stage of that, but there's still sort of a lot of oversight that needs to happen to make sure that there's no backsliding. So at the time they said, well, we think an outsider is the best person to do that. But when they didn't include Carmen Best in those final three, there's pretty widespread uproar, both from inside the police department because she's been there for so long, but also among a lot of people in the community who know her and respect her for what she does.
And we say, yes, there has been uproar. Have we all been agreeing on the facts when there's this criticism of the police department and defense by the police department? Are we all agreeing on what's happening and why? Or would you say there's... You're a reporter following this. Have you been confused up to now?
As far as the police chief selection process? Yeah, I mean, it is confusing because the search process was rolled out that here's this group of 25 people. They're going to give a short list of names to the mayor, and the mayor is going to make the final decision. And that seemed pretty straightforward. But then there was this complicated second tier of people who were not on that original search committee that made this decision of five finalists down to three. And so that was very confusing to people. Who are these people? How are they making these decisions? So I think you had a sort of twofold backlash. One, people genuinely do really like Carmen Best, so they were upset that she was not included. But two, she was excluded in what people saw as a fairly non-transparent way.
Yeah. And then on Saturday evening, Cameron McClay, who I think was widely regarded as a front runner, I think was considered a very strong candidate, withdrew his application. Why was that?
So the exact reasons for why aren't entirely clear. The Seattle Times reported recently that he, even just a week ago, seemed to still be very interested in this job. But on Friday, he and the mayor, Mayor Jenny Durkan, began having conversations about sort of a different role for him rather than police chief. And so apparently those talks went well for both of them, and he agreed that rather than be one of these three finalists for the permanent job, he would transition into some sort of reformer, overseeing these reform efforts in the Seattle Police Department.
Right. He's a reformer overseeing efforts, but these are contentious things to oversee the reform of a police department. If Carmen Best were to get the permanent chief of police position, who's reporting? I mean, obviously she's chief of police. Mm-hmm. If that happened, she's the boss of the reformer, right? Mm-hmm. So what would be so important about bringing in this outsider to answer to the police chief that we have?
Yeah, I think the sort of most positive spin you could put on that would be you get kind of the best of both worlds, I suppose, which is You have Carmen Best, who's got deep roots in the community. People know her. People respect her. She's got buy-in from the rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
All good things. But the concern that sort of eliminated her from the beginning was she was too entrenched in the Seattle Police Department to be able to make the tough decisions about reform. So, you know, again, sort of putting the most positive spin on it, you could see McClay's appointment as sort of bringing that outsider's perspective. He would report directly to whoever the permanent chief is, but he could say, you know, where I did it, I saw it this way, and sort of bring those new perspectives that you might miss from somebody who's kind of just been in the police department for 25 years, as she has.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. You have the, that sounds like some kind of dual role or something, but if, again, this is speculation, but if she were to be the police chief, it's not a dual role. You have chosen the insider as the boss, not the outsider.
Right. Yeah. And that's true. You know, I mean, I don't think that, you know, there are tons of people who report to the police chief and they all have very important jobs. In fact, there is an assistant chief right now whose job is sort of exclusively to oversee some of these reform efforts. So my question is, it wouldn't be so much how McClay would interact, whether there would be some sort of power battle between McClay and Best if she gets the permanent job. It'd be more sort of how he interacts with the assistant chiefs and the captains who are already there. I'm not really even sure what his rank would be, if he would be assistant chief or captain or or what that would look like. And I'm not sure that the mayor's office knows that exactly yet either.
Okay, David Croman, reporter David Croman, Crosscut. You described this the positive spin on what the Seattle Police Department setup would be. That implies there's a not positive spin that you have in mind.
Well, I mean, it's this whole Carmen Best episode was kind of a nightmare for the mayor's office, I would say. I mean, it was really met with a lot of negative coverage from a lot of different sides, and people were pretty upset. So I don't think it's a negative spin, but the more cynical spin would be they sort of realized that this was a screw up, and this is a way out. This is sort of a trap door, which is you get to bring Carmen Best back in while saving some faith to the process.
Right. So, by the way, how is Carmen Best reacting to suddenly being back as one of the three finalists for police chief?
She's thrilled, and that's a quote. She said the word. She's thrilled. I mean, she, when Kathleen O'Toole before her left her post, she didn't hesitate. Carmen Best didn't hesitate at all to say she really wants this job. At the same press conference that Kathleen O'Toole was stepping down, she said, "Yes, definitely, I'm applying for this job." And As her in her time as interim chief, she's made a ton of public appearances, giving talks, really being sort of a forward-looking face of the Seattle Police Department. I don't think she would do that unless she genuinely wanted this. And so when she was excluded from the finalists, she was very professional and didn't sort of let on any sort of disappointment. But it's hard to imagine that she wasn't genuinely disappointed. And because of the news over the weekend, she's kind of full bore ahead. She said she's going to do everything she can to make sure she gets the permanent job.
Okay, David, we're caught up now. And what's the next chapter?
Well, so all three are in town this week. One from Austin, one from Minneapolis, and then, of course, Carmen Best, who's here already. So they'll be out in the community making sort of public appearances. And the mayor is going to, now it's just on to Mayor Durkin. So we had all these committees and these search processes, but now the decision is on the mayor's and the mayor's alone. So she'll be interviewing with them. And I haven't seen a time when she'll actually make the announcement, but I imagine it would be fairly shortly.
The finalists are scheduled to be on KUOW, by the way.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so we'll see whether all that works out. It's all feels in flux now after this weekend's reversal that you've just learned about from city reporter with Crosscut, David Croman. David, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW. Seattle Storm has a new all-time leading scorer. We'll talk to her and more. Stay tuned. Last night, Seattle Storm point guard Sue Bird smashed through the team's all-time leading scorer record. She put up 21 against the Washington Mystics, including these 2 points.
Sue, pull up for the record, and there it is! Sue Bird has surpassed Lauren Jackson as the all-time leading scorer in Seattle Storm history. Congratulations to the future Hall of Famer.
And the future Hall of Famer joins us now. Congratulations, Sue.
Thank you.
Where do you like to watch highlights of yourself breaking the record? ESPN, YouTube? What's your preferred?
The only time I've seen it has been on Twitter and Instagram, so I guess that's my my preferred viewing.
What went through your head when you broke the record? What goes through your head when you watch yourself, highlighted?
Yeah, so I actually didn't know that I was that close to the franchise record.
Really?
I had seen some stuff. Yeah, I had seen some stuff on social media about breaking 6,000, but I was just kind of like, okay, whatever. And then it wasn't until before the game that I was told that, hey, you're 13 points away. And I was like, oh, I had no idea.
How can you not care?
And I kind of joked.
How can you not track that?
Because you just don't track that. If you spend your time tracking that, you won't have any space in your brain for anything else. You can't be bothered.
Okay. I cut you off. You said you were joking about something?
Oh, yeah. And before the game, I even joked, who knows if I'll get it tonight? It might be the next game. Let's not even think about it, you know? So I knew I needed 13. I kind of knew when I hit that shot, okay, that's 13. But at the same time, you're in the middle of a game. You don't have time to really think about anything. And then I don't think it was really till afterwards that I was getting all these congrats and all these text messages from, friends or former teammates or people around the league. So you kind of, that's when you really take a step back and you realize what you've just done.
What about your former teammate who used to hold that record? Have you talked to Lauren Jackson?
Yeah, of course I've talked to her. We joke back and forth. I think, we have so much respect for each other, and yes, I've passed her, but there's no way that in terms of this franchise and scoring that she's not going down as one of the greats. So even though I'm technically ahead of her on that list, we both know who the great scorer is.
You are the leading scorer of the Storm, but you're the all-time assist leader for the whole league, the whole WNBA. What's better, Sue Bird, making an assist or scoring a basket?
For me, it's making the assist. I think scoring is definitely fun. Don't get me wrong. It gets you going in a different way. But when you can make that pass that makes the crowd go, either quiet or make them go ooh and ah, there's something to that.
I'm always curious, Sue, why people who excel. What is it about you? What makes you so great?
I don't know. I think now I'm just at a point in my career where I just try to be as prepared as possible. I try to, cross every T and dot every I, whether it's what I'm eating, how much I'm sleeping, or if it's, getting the game plan ready and making sure I'm ready, making sure my teammates are ready. I find that as long as you do all you need to do in terms of preparation, then once you get on the court, all you got to do is play, and you're not even nervous because you know you've prepared.
The Storm are in first place. They're 15-5. Should the league just give you the title right now?
If only it worked that way, right? No, I am obviously very happy with where we are as a team. Forget the record and forget the seedings. I think we're all just really happy with how we're playing. But we know there's a long way to go. There's no party being thrown for us right now. It's just where we are today. We still have, gosh, I don't even know, a month or so left of the season, and then playoffs, which can be a grind. So we're not trying to get ahead of ourselves.
Well, there is some controversy over in the NBA because the Golden State Warriors are becoming this super team of unbeatable stars. Would you please consider building an unbeatable Seattle Storm super team around you?
Yeah, we just need the millions of dollars to lure people here. That might make it easy.
That's all.
No, I wish. The WNBA, it's not even about the money, I joke. The WNBA doesn't really have the player movement, the free agency that the NBA has. It's just, it's where our business model is a little different. But yeah, if I can get it done, I'll try to do it.
You'd have no problem with being unfairly good on one team, if you could.
I have no problem, truth be told, I have no problem with it when it's done through just the rules. If players are free agents and it's their choice and that's where they choose to go, I mean, who are we to judge that?
What do you want to say to your fans today after becoming the Storm's all-time leader?
Yeah, all I really want to say is thank you. Thank you for showing so much love both in the arena and then, of course, like I said, on social media. I've been getting a lot of tweets, a lot of messages. So I just really appreciate it. I've been in Seattle my entire career, and I've always known that was something special, but I'm really starting to fully understand just how great it is to be in one place and have all these people watch you grow up and see all the things you do on the court and share that with you. So thank you very much.
Sue Bird, all-time assist leader in the WNBA and now all-time scorer for the Seattle Storm after last night. Sue, good to talk with you again. Thanks.
Thanks. You too. Thanks for having me.
This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow is the court-order deadline for the Trump administration to reunite children under the age of five with their families after they got separated at the border by immigration authorities. So today, the government is conducting genetic testing on young children and on their purported guardians hunting for a match. What could the government do with that data? How likely is it to help these families? Is this ethical? Is this legal? To learn more, I have Seattle University law professor Deborah Ahrens with me. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
What is the government proposing to do and why?
To my understanding, they already have begun DNA testing children and parents to try to establish a child-parent relationship, and they're using a third-party DNA testing company to do that.
To see if there's a relationship. We have so many questions around that. We asked on Facebook for our listeners' questions, and Heather writes, what if the child is a stepchild or an adopted child or niece or nephew or grandchild?
Well, and the information about what DNA tests the government is using is fairly limited. It's not clear exactly what tests are being conducted. But the best guess seems to be that the test that the government is likely to be using or that the third-party provider is likely to be using is good at establishing parent-child relationships. So if you are the genetic parent of a child, that should show up. But it's less good about establishing grandparental relationships, an aunt and a niece or an aunt and a nephew. Those kinds of relationships may not show up or may not show up accurately. And certainly if you don't have a genetic relationship with the child, you're not going to show up as genetically related to the child. And that's likely to happen. A number of individuals coming in are likely to be legal guardians or social guardians for immigrant children with whom they're not related. And even someone who believes themselves, for example, to be the biological father of a child may not, for a variety of reasons, actually be that child's biological father. The mother may have had an affair. The mother may have been sexually assaulted. A lot of folks are fleeing countries that have a lot of violence and maybe, in fact, expressly fleeing sexual violence. And so you may have fathers who are not genetically related to children who they are legally the father of.
Okay, so whatever DNA can or cannot establish about this child-adult relationship, what about the legality of children having their DNA sample taken? Can they consent to that legally, a kid?
It's very difficult to think of a 3-year-old or a 10-month-old, as some of the children who are in custody are, as being capable of legally consenting to anything. On the other hand, generally the way in which we govern things that are what we would term searches, and collecting DNA from someone is certainly a search, is we call those searches that are governed under the Fourth Amendment. And normally you need probable cause and a warrant in order to perform a search. When the government is performing the search for some reason other than to investigate crime, however, and here the purpose would be to reunify children and their parents, those searches don't require probable cause, a warrant, or consent. The government might be able to proceed without any particular suspicion, and here they probably would have a decent reason for doing so. So legally, I don't think the government would need consent from the children. Ethically, given the kinds of things that could possibly be done with the DNA once it's collected, I think that's a closer question, particularly if the government has other options for identifying guardian-child relationships.
Why? What do you mean by how this DNA might be used?
Well, and at this point, it's unclear how DNA is going to be used. A government spokesman had said that the swabs themselves would be destroyed, the swabs that are being used to collect DNA. But they didn't say anything about what would happen with the DNA profiles. And that's just a mystery. There aren't really rules about what the government's supposed to do with DNA profiles once they collect them. It's not really clear what the government would do with those DNA profiles. But It's not clear if there's going to be a database that would be used to collect those DNA profiles, but certainly to any extent that DNA is going to be collected and maybe used for other purposes, children aren't in a position to really consent to any of that.
Okay. That answers one of the questions on Facebook that listener Zanna wrote in with. Is a database being created? We don't know. Zanna also wants to know, if a child is deported with their family and then attempts to immigrate again on their own, will their DNA in this database, which we don't know about, be used to profile them later on?
And that's entirely possible. If the government does retain the DNA profiles, you could have someone who is deported at an age where they're not really even aware that that's what's going on. A 10-month-old, even a 5-year-old, probably isn't going to be really aware of the legal processes under which they were deported. And then it is actually a much worse offense to re-enter the United States after you've been deported than to simply enter the United States without authorization. So you could end up in a position, certainly, where you have someone who was deported as a child, the government has retained their DNA profile, and can readily prove that they were actually deported previously.
You mentioned the possibility of other options. I think most people want these families to be reunited, so maybe DNA is the key to bringing many children and families together.
And it certainly may be a process that's quicker than some of the other options that are available now that the government separated the families. Obviously, if the government had not separated the families, we wouldn't be having this conversation in the first place.
Right.
But now that the families are separated, it may be that DNA is the fastest way to reunify at least some of these families. Generally, the government, when it is using DNA in an immigration context, is using it as a last resort once other legal documentation can't prove a particular relationship. But to my understanding, the legal documentation verification takes longer. So that's part of why the government is going to DNA first here.
They do have a court-ordered deadline, right, as we said.
Right. They have a court-ordered deadline, and DNA testing may make it easier for them to meet that deadline. Other methods other than legal documentation. To my understanding, a number of parents have been able, again, based on court order, to establish phone contact with their children. So maybe there are processes related to that, interviews and so forth, that could be conducted to establish the parent-child relationship or the guardian-child relationship. But it may be that the reason the government is using DNA is because that process is likely to be faster.
Yeah, I can imagine tomorrow's court-ordered deadline is for 5-year-olds and younger. I remember when my kids were under 5, I don't know that anything they would have said to an immigration official would have been helpful, you know, necessarily. I don't know that they would have known how to help track down their dad.
No, I think that that's right. I have a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I don't think either of them could give you my full name,
right,
anything other than mom. I'm not sure either of them. I'm certainly sure that the 2-year-old doesn't know her address or what country she's in. So absolutely, I think with very young children, it's probably difficult based on interviews with the children themselves to establish that relationship.
So if the best case scenario is families are reunited, do you have a worst case scenario in mind right now?
I think one of the worst case scenarios we've already talked about a bit, which is that there are going to be children who won't be reunited with their guardians because they don't have a biological parent-child relationship with them.
Yeah.
So that's certainly a really terrible outcome that can happen here if you don't have that kind of ability to establish. The other bad outcome is one we simply don't know about. Most people don't voluntarily surrender DNA samples to the government because they worry about what might be done later on down the line to be used in a law enforcement context, to be used to deny them health care. Other things that we don't even know are possible negative consequences of the federal government having your DNA. So the second bad thing that could happen is we're just not sure. We're not sure what use the government could put DNA samples to in the future.
Again, tomorrow is the court-ordered deadline for the Trump administration to reunite the youngest children under 5 with their families. Any chance they're going to meet that deadline?
Since the government's already saying no, I'm doubtful that they're going to meet the deadline.
Okay. We've been talking with Deborah Aaron. She's Associate Professor of Law at Seattle University, talking about how much we still don't know. Let's keep following it then together and keep learning together, Professor.
No, absolutely.
Okay, we'll do it again. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Fake news on the UW campus in a moment. Back with The Record on KUOW, I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to KUOW Real News. Just trust me. not the fake stuff.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
So President Trump, they're referring to sources like CNN or USA Today, sources we in the news business wouldn't call fake. But that doesn't mean false news stories don't exist, and it can be hard to figure out what is real and what's not. So University of Washington professors Jevin West and Carl Bergstrom created a class called Calling BS. It is now an official course at the UW, and they join us in the studio to talk about it. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Bill. It was fun talking with you last time. And
yep.
Now we've got a year of what we've learned from the students and what we've learned in teaching the class. So it's been fun. I think one of the big things we learned is that students know that this is a problem, and they're taking the class, and they come from all walks of life.
Yes. So they come from all walks of life to take a Calling BS class, the synopsis of which says, our world is saturated with BS. Learn to detect it and diffuse it. How do you diffuse BS, Carl?
Well, the idea is you want to try to explain to people why BS is wrong. You got to spot it, first of all, and then you've got to be able to refute it in various ways. And that may not be just yelling at the top of your lungs.
No?
I don't know. That's what I do on the internet. But what you should do, you know, is think about your audience and think about, how do I reach my audience? How do I explain to my audience what it is that I want to get through, what's wrong with this story that I see? And that can be really, really different depending on whether your audience is, your uncle or your academic colleagues, if you're a student, working in some area of the sciences or whatever the case may be.
What's an example of a skill you'll teach in this Calling BS class?
So, I mean, one of the simplest things is we just ask the students to question their source, like, who's telling me this? How do they know it? And what do they have to gain from it? And also little principles like, if it sounds too good to be true, or too bad, it probably is. That one proves is I use almost every single day.
Really? Aren't some things just wonderful or terrible enough to be true?
That in times they
it's
are
the minority.
That is. But put that flag out, you know. Anytime you hear that. But I mean, the other big things. Our focus on the class is around the ways that in which you can BS with data. So with graphics, with figures, with statistics, and that's really our expertise. Because there's organizations around the country that are really fighting back at this. I think that's the sort of silver lining in all this, is that there's been a concerted effort from industry, from the journalism world, from the public, and from governments to really fight back. And our specialty is in teaching students, when they see a graph that's been zoomed out so far and they claim there's no trend in temperatures around the earth, that they should maybe consider the ways in which that graph was created and zoom back in and see maybe that there's a 2-degree increase over the last 50 years.
But how do I spot? I mean, I see a graph. It's not like the graph has some kind of warning, this is sketchy.
Well, that's right. I think there are some kind of principles that we try to teach people to think about. One is just to think about the way that the axes are being used to create an impression. So if there's a very small difference between, say, $1,000 return and $1,005 return, and I say, oh, my fund is doing way better than your fund. Hmm. If I cut a graph, where I cut the axes off at 999 and just go up from there, it's like one bar is really small, the other bar is really huge, makes it look like there's an enormous difference between two bars on a bar graph. Just teaching people to be aware of these kinds of tricks. And I think that's been one of the things that's so much fun with students. We do this all the way through with middle schoolers on up, and we teach them some of these things, and then we have them look at their own data, and we say, okay, now try to convince us of this story. Try to convince us that single payer healthcare is great or single payer healthcare is terrible, using these true data that we've pulled from say the World Bank. And
is there true data? There's not.
Oh, that is a good question. That's a good question.
Because you could argue that you just select your data.
Well, okay. So that's a very good question. I think there is more and less reliable data.
Okay.
And I tend to be relatively fond of these NGOs and sorts of things as data sources. But you're right to call me on that.
By the way, when we talk about misleading graphs, now we're talking about, in journalism, now we're talking about bad journalism. But I started off talking about fake news.
Right.
Do you cover both? What's the important difference?
Yeah, so we do. We have, like, again, our focus is on that, the sort of ways in which information and arguments are conveyed through numbers. But we have several weeks devoted to fake news and sort of the digital world that students and the public live in nowadays. And so we talk about the kinds of things that you can look out for in, you know, your social media platforms. I mean, just even just today, you know, Twitter came out and admitted that they're sort of knocking out about 1 million fake accounts a day. So over the last couple of months, they've knocked out over 70 million. So given that there's 300 million in the United States, that should tell the users of Twitter and Facebook and all these major social media platforms that a lot of what's running it are bots and fake accounts. And so
it's how am I, besides being skeptical, how am I supposed to spot that?
Yeah. So, I mean, what you would want to do is corroborate that. Look for multiple sources that are claiming this. As you get better and better at this, there are certain sources you can trust more than others. I think fact-checking organizations play an incredibly important role for society. I wish we'd give them more money, but they can only take so much money because they can't take it from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So places like, you know, Snopes, which is, you know, located in Tacoma here in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Mythbusters.
Yeah, the Mythbusters are really a valuable source for students. And also, I mean, just looking for, again, those things that just sound too good to be true, and not even having to look at, you know, sort of little strange things going on with websites.
I mean, I'll go out on a limb here and say I'm a big fan of the mainstream media, so to speak.
Thank you.
And so, you know, one thing that we really try to encourage our students to do is to look for corroboration there. It's been stunning to me as sort of a, you know, old guy to realize how few of our students are getting their information directly from a newspaper or even a radio show. It's all coming on Twitter, Facebook, whatever it is that they're using.
Twitter, well, Facebook, those are so old, right, to these the are, students.
These are, right. Whatever the new social media platforms are, that's where people are getting their information. And so just teaching to our students to, this is one of the most important things we say. You say, you know, dig back to the source. You know, you got this, you heard this, you know, tweet, so now dig back to the news story. Read the news story. Well, where did the news story get it? Well, they got it from a scientific paper. If you really care, go back and look at that scientific paper, because there's a lot of slippage that happens between what's in the paper and what's in the news story. You know, if the paper says, well, we kind of provisionally think maybe it's a little bit likely that perhaps red wine prevents cancer, you know, the news story is going to say red wine prevents cancer,
yes.
Period.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I say, you know, they'll turn a correlation into causation. Correlation doesn't imply causation, but it doesn't sell newspapers either. And
right.
You've got to. So
especially anyway. The social science studies where they use people. I'm skeptical of a lot of what they come up with, though it's very entertaining.
It is very entertaining, and I'm skeptical of those, too. The sort of dirty secret is that a lot of the stuff in biomedicine is really not any more solid.
Interesting.
Than that.
Do you have a story of a student who learned that something was fake, that and that was mind-blowing or life-changing?
Oh, we had...
Tell me a story.
So many of... I'll tell you the one principle that gets used the most, and it's the if it sounds too good to be true. We have students... I remember a student specifically running up to us after and said, I think I found something that sounds too good to be true. And he comes in and we look it up and he was right. It sounded too good to be true. But the one... There's the students that we have at the University of Washington, international students, they really take this especially serious. We have students from China, and we've had many of them come up and say, we really want to translate these lectures into our native language so that we can share this with our country. It's not that, you know, China's the only place, but I found that with a lot of the Chinese students, a lot of these things were really eye-opening, and we had many emails sent to us, you know, sort of emotional kinds of emails that sort of indicated that some of these techniques, they'd never taken a class like that. It was sort of the common sort of response.
And the problem is enormous in Asia as well. I mean, which was also something I learned. I would have thought, boy, could it really be worse than it is here in the U.S.? And my students from China and India say, oh, yeah, people are even less skeptical there. And the information that's flowing around on social media is even more incorrect than what we're seeing here in the U.S.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
So I found that really striking.
Yes. So, and I understand there may be some disagreement between the two of you here. We're talking with Jevin West, Carl Bergstrom, two University of Washington professors who have this course called Calling BS. I want to know which is improving faster, our ability to produce fake news or our ability to spot and diffuse fake news?
Yeah, so this has been an absolute disaster, in my opinion, is that we went to a world where all the computers in the world were networked. We've got the internet. Now everyone can produce information. that was sort of all right. That was supposed to democratize the content out there. But now all of a sudden there's too much content. So what happens? So we have to figure out how do we decide what to look at? And our solution in this world has been that we all become editors. We're all editors on social media. We all decide what our friends read. We are terrible editors. We don't care. We don't have the same incentives. We don't have the right training.
Yes.
It's a mess. And so what happened is we've opened this.
You're all your own curator, and you're awful at it.
We're terrible at it. Yeah. We've unleashed a Pandora's box that is, in my opinion, really threatening our current democracy. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea what to do about it. So I'm a deep pessimist about this.
Well, and that's exactly why we developed this class, because Carl and I both were sort of depressed at night when we were chatting over our work, that we, you know, things that we found in our work and also in our everyday lives, that the best thing that we could do, because I work in the area of, you know, data science and machine learning, and everyone's got an idea on how to fight fake news with technology. And I'm sorry, that is a tough task for AI. And there's companies being acquired right now by Facebook and Twitter that claim they can do this. I'm very skeptical of this. So the thing that Carl and I says, well, the one thing we know how to do is teach. So let's create this class. Let's inform the consumer that is doing the filtering, since the gatekeepers don't have that primary role anymore. And I will say that of the two, I'm probably more of an optimist than Carl, just because I do see just the fact that students are clamoring to take this class and other classes around the country, the fact that this class now is being taught in universities around the country, and other faculty and other organizations are developing these kinds of classes, and you know, the governments and journalists and all the conferences I go to. So I have this sort of a little bit more positive attitude about where we're going. I think it's going to take some time to clean up, but we've been through it before. I mean, people were comparing the printing press back in the 1400s to a brothel because of dirtying the sort of the integrist words. So I think we're gonna work through this.
All right. Well, let's hope human intelligence can improve faster than the artificial intelligence. And both of you seem a little skeptical that AI is going to save us. So it's got to happen in classes like calling BS. University of Washington professors Jevin West is assistant professor in the Information School. Carl Bergstrom, theoretical and evolutionary biologist. It's official. It's in the course book now. And good on you. Continue to call BS and come back with us.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it.
More with The Record on KUOW Seattle in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. An Australian comic is making waves for her new Netflix stand-up special, Nanette. Here's a clip from the trailer where the comedian Hannah Gadsby contemplates quitting comedy. It's this reversal partway through the show.
I do think I have to quit comedy, though. And it's probably not the forum to make such an announcement, is it? I have built a career out of self-deprecating humour, and I simply will not do that anymore, not to myself or anybody who identifies with me. Do you understand what self-deprecation means? It's not humility. It's humiliation.
Okay, so that's a bit from the trailer, but what she does in the show apparently is, I haven't seen it, but but both of you have?
Yes.
Yeah, so she lures you in with the comedy, and then we're talking about how we think about comedy and when it's okay and not okay to make a joke. My guests here to talk about this and more stories from our weekend is Valerie Curtis Newton, head of the directing program at the UW School of Drama. Welcome back.
Thanks. You so much.
Good to see you again. And David Schmader, writer-performer, who was editor, columnist for The Stranger. Good to see you again, David. Thanks.
Hello.
So, Valerie, what struck you about this comedy show, Nanette?
I thought that it did the thing that I'm most excited about in art, in that it entertains you. It reminds you that it's possible to laugh. And then when you're really listening, when she knows you're really listening, she says the really important thing that she wanted to say to you from the very beginning. Mm. So a really good writer or performer has a way of tapping into the core humanity and then being able to either hold up a mirror that says, this is what you are, or this is what I am.
And to you, what was that important thing she got around to saying?
That that people victimize each other all the time, and that it's possible to be complicit in your own victimization, and that she made the decision to stop being complicit and to hold other people accountable for their actions. that little that clip you played about not being humiliated, deciding to be humble but not humiliated, was a really important, I think, thing to say, because we as a culture, as Western cultures, are really big on pride and standing up in a certain way. And when you stand up, you become this huge target. And what people do is then they play low status all the time.
They play low status?
They play low status, which sort of says, don't really look at me over here doing this thing. I'm really nobody. So you don't have to be afraid of me. So you don't have to attack me. So you don't have to, just don't pay attention. I can't hurt you. I won't hurt you. I'm just going to come in under the radar. And what she said is, finally, I'm standing up to my full height. And if you can't handle it, that's your issue. Your feelings are not my issue any longer.
Well, when it comes to comedy, David, what she says in that quote is, I built a career out of self-deprecation, and I don't want to do that anymore. Do you understand what self-deprecation means from somebody who already exists in the margins? And she's lesbian, this woman, Hannah Gatsby. She says, it's not humility, it's humiliation. Is she criticizing comedy, David, or just a certain kind of self-deprecating comedy?
I think it's a certain type of self-deprecating comedy, and I think so much of it has to do with her being a non-gender conforming lesbian from Tasmania. So much of the power comes from that, because no one could say self-deprecating comedy is going out the window, because if a powerful, it's kind of the only tool in a powerful white male comedian's arsenal. It's, if you have the power, go after yourself. I think it was more about this way to make yourself digestible and an acceptable punchline kind of persona of, oh, I'm the lesbian from Tasmania. It's like, no more. You're going to hear what it's really like to be a lesbian from Tasmania now. And so much of the power of it comes from what I didn't know about how regressive Tasmania is. It was illegal to be homosexual there till 1997, which is when Radiohead released OK Computer, just for history
buffs. Thank you.
Thank you. It's like recent.
Yes.
And so it was felt way more personal for her of, like, I will not take this common path to comedy success, which is, oh, look at me, I'm just a bag of guts, when I'm living in a world that really does treat me like I'm just a bag of guts.
Do you get the so in the show, it sounds like she does stand-up comedy and then turns against stand-up comedy in a way and explains what really happened in those wacky stories that she had to leave out because it wasn't punchline-y. But do you, Valerie, think that she is leaving behind comedy, really?
I don't. I think she's okay. Decided to tell the truth. And whatever shape the truth takes, actually to stand up for that. Whereas,
do people want to listen to that? If I'm not going to get pulled, so you're a stranger and you're going to tell me devastating stories. Oh, and I'm not going to get to laugh
no,
in relief.
No, I think you're making a mistake, which is that, in fact, the pain of our life doesn't actually contain humor. Mm. Because it does. You can't watch somebody like Richard Pryor and think that his life was all roses. In fact, he would tell he told the story of his heart attack, and it was hysterically funny because he had a gift for making us laugh. And I think if she has the gift of comedy, it doesn't matter whether it's a setup in a punchline or whether it's a true story that's poignant and difficult to accept on its own. It's the finding the humor in it, regardless. But telling the truth, I think she's decided not to lie to make other people comfortable. And I get it. I get that as a Black queer woman, that it's really, I'm often challenged with how do I make other people feel comfortable with me. And knowing where the line is for me, what allows me not to be curled up in my bed day after day, but in fact to go out into the world, is that I have to tell tell the truth, sometimes in situations where it's not wanted to be heard. And
yeah.
Be okay with the consequences of having told the truth.
David, maybe that gets us to our next topic that talking about rather than curling up, what do we do instead of curling up in our bed? You were saying that we're going to talk about the resistance and civility rearing its head again, right? So there's a connection there. What do we do? What do we do?
Yeah. Like I tossed out and out when we were talking about stuff was like, the rhythm of my life these days is horrified by facts of the news,
uh-huh.
and then what I do to divert and or sustain myself from so I am ready for more horrible facts from the news and don't want to kill myself or anyone else.
Yes.
So just these kind of little entertainment art drugs we give ourselves. It could be a song you love that just like gets you where you need to go. And Nanette, I think that one reason I love the Nanette special so much is we're at a point, we're at a really coarse point in our national dialogue. And I love that people are still fussing over the finer points of representation and discussion and how you talk about yourself when we have a president who is a blatant racist. And like that, there's maybe some people would say, like, are we arguing about which fork to use when the house is on fire? Mm-hmm. It's like, no, it's important that we keep some standards and we keep progressing forward and not let the kind of crudeness of the national conversation drag us away from these more pointed conversations that also need to be had and can't be drowned out because we have a monster in charge right
now. Okay, well, so let's talk about keeping our standards and whether we're getting dragged away, because over the weekend there was more yelling at Republicans in their personal space. This is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell being pursued by protesters through a restaurant parking lot in Louisville.
Where are the babies?
Vote you out! Vote you out!
Yeah.
Vote you out! 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 Fuck you out!
What are you doing to get the babies back?
Yeah, we know where you live, too, Mitch. We know where you live.
Are you reacting to "We know where you live"?
Oh, that ruins it.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that is happening, just in our culture overall, is the use of our own personal video abilities. So there's always been police brutality, but now there are 100 cell phones taking that video and posting it. There has always been a harassment of our public officials by the opposition party. There always has been. But now it's videotaped and broadcast and millions of people can like it. And so there's a way in which it's reverberating louder. It's a behavior that has always existed, but now it reverberates louder because of the way that the internet works, the way that media works now. And I think it's very interesting. When Ellen DeGeneres came out in the early 90s, there was this huge wave of conservative backlash. They boycotted everybody who even said her name. All the advertisers were boycotted. Her show got canceled. In that time, for those people, voicing your opinion about what was on the show to the advertisers was a tactic that was acceptable.
So how do you compare that with...
When it's turned, and now people are attacking going after the advertisers for Laura Ingraham, for going after the Parkland students, now the liberals are so hypersensitive curtailing free speech by making people have consequences. But it's always been there.
But do you want the consequence to come up when a Republican is dining?
I think this could really help a lot, is if those people were yelling something positive, like, you're great at being terrible, or keep it away from, like, we know where you live. But I think it's perfectly fine to, if there's a government employee, we're living through an extreme time. And if you can, why I was so mad about "We Know Where You Live" is because that ruined it. I think you can disrupt an evening of a politician who is doing immoral things with no compunction, but we've got to keep emotion out of it. We've got to keep threats out of it. It's just got to be, you don't belong in society if you're going to behave this way.
What about Turtlehead?
That is a personal slight, except it's also a fact. It's just,
it's just factual observance of Mitch McConnell's actual head. Okay. Valerie, what do you do when you are feeling anger or hopelessness? And of course, I'm asking for a friend, and my friend is the listeners to this radio station.
This is one of my deep, dark secrets. I'm pretty prolific on Facebook. I share lots of news. I get it from lots of different sources, and I share a lot of things. But the thing I cannot resist are videos of dancing babies.
Dancing babies. David, did a little hands dance.
No, there's no arguing.
Are these videos or animation? Are the babies actually dancing?
They're on YouTube.
Okay.
And
they're on YouTube.
People post videos of their children dancing to whatever the tunes are.
Uh-huh.
And they are always so free, so uninhibited, and so flat out happy that it's infectious. And so I post them I repost them and retweet them so that other people can have that moment of a giggle when that little boy starts doing the cowboy dance or that little girl starts being a ballerina.
Can you be, are you that uninhibited personally? Can you still be?
Not very often. There are some moments in some circles where I can be flat out silly, but I don't try to tell that to everyone all the time. It ruins my mystique and my allure.
David, you still have a, is there a dancing baby inside of you?
There, I do like a dancing baby. I like all sorts of little endorphin hit videos. For secular people, it's kind of our main trapping of like, here's an emotion for you that we can share.
Yes.
My big thing since the entire Trump administration has been I'm super into film noir. I can't deal with violence, so I really like movies from 1944 to 1959 where like there's a shadow and a knife and the wind blows the curtain.
The curtain,
across.
Yeah.
So really into that. That's kind of been my big thing is I'll just watch a nice contained crime story that's already been made like 500 years ago.
I think it's just so important to figure out what brings you a moment of relief because otherwise the thing that happens, we want to save some part of our humanity, keep it alive. And so making the decision to remember to laugh keeps open the possibility that it's going to be a better day tomorrow.
Thanks for keeping it alive with us for a few minutes today. Valerie Curtis-Newton, head of directing program, UW School of Drama, oversees the Hansberry Project, professional African-American theater lab. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
David Schmader, writer, performer, now a senior editor at Leafly and author of the book Weed, The User's Guide, Whatever Gets You Through. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
The Record on KUOW.